Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on RaconteursNews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on RaconteursNews.com. Well, we're coming to you live from the lair of the Dark Wolf at the Conscious Tribal Gathering in Glyndyfrdwy in northish kind of Wales. And on tonight's show, we've got a variety of guests lined up as usual when we do these live broadcasts. So I'm going to be chatting first of all with Synchro, who has successfully made landfall back in UK PLC after a truly exotic outing to foreign parts. Then we'll be talking to the Dark Wolf himself, who has a few concerns about the apparently newly okayed nuclear power plant in Somerset, just where we want one. And later on we'll be talking to Jamie, who's turning out some totally amazing food here. And Sook will be on, because I gather he's out to waken the world. There will of course be a liberal smattering of tunes throughout whilst we change over guests and try and find people. And that last one was X-Ray Vision, Psychic Warfare is Real from Clutch. I really like those guys. Apparently they've been around for a long time, but I only recently encountered them. Before that, an oldie, David Bowie, Friday on My Mind. And the Alabama 3, Monday Don't Mean Anything to Me, which it certainly doesn't at this stage. We've got a really nice little gig coming together around us, don't you think, Synchro? Welcome back to the show, mate.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's really nice to be in a field by the River Dee again.
It's every bit as comfortable and friendly and relaxing as we remember it, isn't it?
Oh, it's stunning. There's loads of familiar faces and quite a few new ones as well. Yeah. And everybody's just like really enjoying being in the field. And quite a few of us were enjoying being in the river earlier on as well. It's brilliant to swim in the Dee. It's just fantastic.
It's going to be quite interesting, this one, because we've got a lot more people coming to it than usual. It's kind of a couple of hundred people, but I can see that it's been deliberately programmed to actually have very relatively few presentations, maybe a couple a day, a lot of workshops. So the whole, because one of the things that people really enjoy about this one, the Conscious Tribal Gathering and the Truth Juice Gatherings, it's always the bits in between, isn't it, that are so good. And this year they seem to be really encouraging that.
Yeah, I think having less of a programme, more kind of workshop interactive type things, and also just time for people, like you say, to mill about and chat and swim together and sit round a fire together, and it's just great. Yeah.
Human beings being human, we love it. So we're also hoping that maybe on Saturday night we might be able to do a bonus show for a couple of hours, probably also between 9 and 11, but that is TBA in the meantime. Really, it's great to be able to catch up with Synchro. Obviously, I've missed you. I've had to do all the washing up myself, mate. So you've been, you're presenting this year here. You're going to do a talk called Walking the Path, Labyrinth and Pilgrimage, and you've recently been on another pilgrimage. What was it like? Where have you been? What have you been doing?
Well, you could call it a pilgrimage. I've been struggling with that word for some years, because you know, in 2008 when I went on that long walk from Cornwall to Norfolk, that was being called a pilgrimage, and ever since then I've been wondering what it is. So this little talk that I'm giving has come about as a result of wondering what the nature of doing a pilgrimage really is. And obviously a lot of people do it for religious motives, but I'm looking at it from a slightly different perspective and to see what other people might gain from doing a pilgrimage of some sort.
I know you've made the point before that just walking for several days on end and knowing that that's what you're going to do, knowing when you go to bed at night that you'll get up tomorrow and you'll walk some more, that in itself is a kind of pilgrimage. It's a sort of pilgrimage into yourself, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think there's, you know, there is the outer journey of a pilgrimage and the inner journey of a pilgrimage, and they are inseparable. It's just that you might set about doing a pilgrimage to explore an inner world that you don't even know exists until you walk for several days, maybe even weeks at a time, and get into the rhythm of camping, going to sleep, waking up, packing up, get off on the road again, walk, camp, sleep, eat, you know. It's a rhythm that we don't often feel in our, what a lot of people call our everyday lives, but I'd like to see it becoming more of a part of our everyday lives, to be honest.
It'd be great if we had the time to get around like that so that, you know, that your walking is actually functional, because in India they move around all the time, don't they? It's like a huge transient population.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Indian people travel a lot, and when I was there, I mean, they were the majority of tourists were Indian people visiting different parts of India for various reasons. But like the Tibetans as well, you know, I mean, they will travel sometimes thousands of miles to reach a pilgrimage destination. Like Mount Kailash, for example, people will literally travel for thousands of miles to get there. Then they'll perambulate around the mountain for a few days, and then they'll celebrate because they've gained loads of merit by doing it, and then they'll bloody well walk home, you know?
It's actually quite a common national pastime outside the UK, isn't it? There's loads and loads of peoples who seem to have these annual pilgrimage and have their holy mount, the mountain or whatever, and we just appear to have lost all of that for some reason.
Well, I mean, there are some pilgrimages in, definitely in Ireland, there's a very well-known one called Croagh Patrick, which is mainly a Christian pilgrimage, although it attracts people from all over the world to walk, apparently over a million people a year walk up and down Croagh Patrick. But they have these annual festivals where lots and lots of Catholic people walk up and down the mountain. And a lot of them do it for the sake of what is known as penance, which I actually have quite a large difficulty with myself.
Yeah. No remorse, that's what we say.
You know, what is penance, and why should we feel that we have to torture ourselves up and down mountains, walking barefoot, with sometimes with crosses on their backs? How could we feel that we possibly needed to suffer to gain any kind of understanding of the world as we know it, you know?
Hang on a moment, we've got our host here. Hi, Adij, what can we do for you, matey?
I'm just looking for you to show me how to log into this so I can broadcast downstairs.
Oh. Okay, right, yeah, if you go to raconteursnews.com, it should, and then go to the live chat room.
Which one's that?
What's it say on there? I can't see you. Yes, that's the right page. If you find the live chat box, and I'm sure they'll let you in, because we're going to be broadcasting this down in the marquee. We are, and maybe people down there will want to come up here. So that's great. That's where the kitchen posse are at the moment. Apart from Synchro here, the kitchen posse are down in the tent there. Yeah, I was wondering whether, is there any evidence that people were doing things like Croagh Patrick before the Catholics came along?
Yeah, apparently Croagh Patrick has been walked regularly on an annual basis since the Stone Age. People were doing it then for different reasons, I believe. They were doing it for welcoming in the harvest and celebrating the beginning of spring and things like that. And I'm not sure that the word penance had even entered their vocabulary.
I would imagine that some of it, from remembering what I read in the Megalithic Empire, some of these pilgrimage must have been so that all the tribes could meet up and do their trading and, I don't know, marrying and whatever else, have their games and whatever.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we know that Avebury was a big centre for people to meet and celebrate, and tribes, like you say, to get together. And they were living in a time of peace. As far as we know, what we know as the Neolithic era was a time of peace, and people traded and people got on with each other. And, you know,
so the pilgrimage, a bit like so many other things, would appear to have been appropriated by Christianity. Well, and of course the other axial age religions.
Well, I'd say most definitely. And we know that they appropriated ancient sites, sacred groves, stone circles were incorporated into churchyards. And, you know, there's some magnificent examples of churches that have been built in the most extraordinary places. And, you know, good on them. But that was their habit, was to take over ancient sites and then adjust them to their own purposes and their own theories, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know that It would take quite a lot to pull you out of the vegetable garden at the time of year when we're sowing all the seeds and stuff like that, because I know how much you love that time of year. So I'm assuming it was a pretty special thing that you were doing. Where have you been? Would you like to let us know what and why did you do it? You know, that's what I want to know. I never even made it to Brighton.
Well, yeah, I've just been to Peru and Bolivia, and I came back last Friday, so I'm still in the landing process, I think you might say. But I've always wanted to go to Bolivia. I've always had a special place for it in my heart. I used to dream about Bolivia when I was tiny, but I'd never heard of Bolivia or seen what the people there were. So I had this, I felt I had this connection somehow with Bolivia. I wanted to go. So when this chance for this walk and 21 days of activity with this group in Bolivia came up, I pressed the button on the computer that said yes, you know, and that was it basically. And then, as you know, I had to go jump through all sorts of hoops to get my passport renewed and do all sorts of things to make this trip possible. And at times I wondered, you know, is this worth it? Is this totally insane? Yeah. But having been and had the education I've had since I've been there, which we'll probably talk about at some other point, and I'll have had time then for it to sort of sink in. But I already think it was worth the whole trip and the long-haul flight for the education I've had about people and how the people in Peru, given half a chance, conduct their lives in the most harmonious, abundant fashion I have seen in a long time. The kids have got so much freedom, you know, everybody's getting on, no soap opera behaviour on the streets. Such a safe place to be. I just felt so safe there and so welcomed, really, into the community. You spend a few days in this community and then you're getting to know people. You know, it's brilliant.
Well, let's talk about that a bit, because you moved backwards and forwards over the border between Peru and Bolivia, and Bolivia was where the work was being done, wasn't it? And you kind of spent a bit of time in Peru before and afterwards. And I know the memory that seems to have stuck most with you is that village that you stayed in Peru. And I know the two countries were different, but what was it like there? Give people some idea of what you were doing.
Well, we came back from the mountains and La Paz, which is another story, capital of Bolivia. No, it's not even the capital of Bolivia, but it's a very important city in Bolivia. Total hellhole, really, a city in a big hole in the ground. But yeah, we arrived in Peru and then we travelled across the border to Bolivia, which is a bit of a palaver. They have to stamp your passport and all that kind of kit. You have to get out and walk through across the border and the bus follows through and it's like a bit mad. But Bolivia seems to me in just a month's time, to be a country which is in a state of massive change. Hardly any of the roads are finished in Bolivia. They're all being built. And it's like this, agrarian subsistence economy that is just having this massive development infrastructure laid on it, and they haven't got the means or the machinery or the... You see guys out with spades digging new roads and stuff, you know. They really haven't got that ready yet. But in terms of the people that we met, I mean, we had a wonderful welcome everywhere we went, and there weren't many gringos. There weren't many tourists on the trek that we went on. Yeah. So we did meet people in a local fashion in their villages, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
And you were up there, you were working around Lake Titicaca. What's that like? Because it's, for those who don't know, it was at least originally a saltwater lake. And it's like 12,000 feet above sea level.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, when you're on the shores of Lake Titicaca, you are actually at 12,000 feet, which is quite high, and you have to acclimatise to the altitude thing. And then, of course, the mountains surrounding Lake Titicaca are much higher, and we drove for hours to get to this lovely little town called Pelechuca, and then from there we walked up into the mountains, and we crossed like four mountain passes in 6 days. And, Yeah, I mean, it was...
What was the highest pass? How high did you go, Singh?
Well, we went higher than I've been in a long time. We went up to, like, 16,000 feet. Yeah. Nearly 17,000 feet.
And what was that like? How did you manage? Because, I mean, that's way above the 450 we're used to.
Yeah, no, it takes some acclimatising, and thankfully we'd had time in Cuzco, in Peru, which is also at 11,000 feet. So you're pretty high there. So you get a chance to acclimatise, and you just get used to it. And when we got back to Cuzco, having done the mountains in Bolivia, it was easy walking up and down those narrow streets and all those steps and stuff. It was so much easier having done the mountains.
Yeah.
Because we adapt, our blood adapts apparently to be at high altitude.
Right.
And then it'll come back, it'll readapt to being at low altitude when we come back down.
And how did your group manage? Because of course this is another of those gigs where you actually get a random load of people of random competencies and ideas from all over the world turning up to do breathing work at 12,000 feet. How did that go?
Well, look, everybody has their individual journey in the group. But it is a group, and there were some, I'd say it was quite a disparate group, basically. It didn't really gel, which in its own way brings its own learning. And I learnt a lot from kind of working with that group, and it's interesting to see how these things work out. I mean, one of the best things was that we had some native Peruvian people working with us, and they were a real kind of oil on the waters, if you like, for the group, because they got on with the individuals in the group. Mm-hmm. So that was really good. And even though the group didn't really gel, we still did it. We got through.
It's quite Shakespearean, isn't it? The the paying punters talking to each other through the porters. I quite like that.
Yeah.
And did you meet any kind of curanderos or any traditional shaman styly healers? Did you see any of that sort of thing over there?
Yeah, we did. We went to this. Three or four days of our trek were all centered around this sacred mountain called Akamani, which is a masculine mountain. It has its counterpart next door called Chuco, I think. But every masculine element in the landscape, if you like, including people, have their female counterparts. So that their leaders, their local leaders, are elected and they rule, if you like, or they go through their time of influence as spokespeople for the community. They do it with their female counterpart, which I think is a really brilliant idea. I think we should adopt some of that ourselves.
They're famously unstable kind of political regimes, aren't they? And it does the Bolivia, because I mean, Peru sounds like Synchro will come back on the show at a bit later in the year with some photographs and some really exotic things she's seen. But it seems to me from what you've said that the Peruvian experience was a flourishing agrarian economy, although it was having an awful lot of money taken off the top of it that it never saw. Whereas Bolivia, just over the border, it sounds like some kind of Eastern European regime, because you said that it basically seemed to be split simply down yes-no lines, and that's about as far as any kind of debate went.
I mean, La Paz, although I say it's a hellhole in the ground, which it is, it's so busy, it's just incredible, but it is a very vibrant city, and every single day in La Paz there are protests on the streets. People are out there, you know, protesting, saying what they've got to say, basically. And there are hold-ups in the traffic every single day due to that. So it is a very... People are speaking their minds in Bolivia. We actually visited one town called... can I remember? Something like Cachahuaca. but that's not quite right. But this town had a reputation for being... forthright and saying no to politicians that they found didn't work for the people and stuff. And this town had this reputation for being amazing. And Daniel Stone, our guide, one of our guides, he left a bag in a restaurant in this town, With over $3,000 worth of Bolivianos in it.
All the cash for the trip.
Yeah. We'd travelled miles back to get to this bag. Went into the restaurant. They hadn't even looked in the bag to see what was in there. They'd kept it for him. Yeah. And when he got it back, it was so jubilant. Yeah. But the people there were straight, you know. They were like amazing people.
We could balance that story with a bit of a tale about the buses and how they get them across to that little island, because that's an amazing story. They've got basically, well, you tell them about that.
Well, it's a bit of a shock when you first do it, but you turn up in your bus and you're on your way to La Paz, and there's this isthmus in Lake Titicaca. Oh, sorry, mate. There's this narrow bit where they run boats over, and your bus goes over on a massive great big barge with a couple of minibuses, and you, all the people, go over in boats. And the government were throwing all this development money at the country, and they said, oh, well, we'll build a bridge over here. And the boat people said, no, if you build a bridge, we'll kill the people who come here to build it. So they've kept their monopoly on the crossing. It's amazing crossing. I love it. Really exciting.
It's brilliant, that, isn't it? Yeah, you build a bridge if you want to, but if you do, we'll kill you. And we're not talking about, like, the occasional coach on the occasional barge here. We're talking, like, It looks like bloody Vienna or something, but made up of barges with coaches on them. And then they bundle, don't they? They bundle as many people as possible onto the people boats, which, of course, is a much bigger risk than your stable bus. But you've also got to be careful about where you leave your stuff on the bus, haven't you?
Yeah, you don't want to leave anything on the bus, because seems to be a bit of a free-for-all on the way over, and people just help themselves to whatever they find on the bus. So you take your bag with you. It only costs like 2 Bolivianos, which is like no money at all to cross this crossing, but it's a hell of a trip. It's very exciting. Yeah. I can recommend it.
So, yeah, so coming up on the show in future weeks, there will be a slideshow of some really amazing things that Jess saw while she was there. We'll also be talking a little bit about the somewhat bizarre but obviously extremely lucrative creaming off operation that seems to be running in all of the ancient sites, making it very difficult for, you know, people to just turn up and go and hang out in one. Anyway, that was hopefully a really great introduction, Jess, for everybody to that. Thanks very much for joining us and being the first one on tonight.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, mate. I'll go and find your next guest then, shall I? Yeah.
Jess, as regular listeners to the live broadcast will know, it gets a little bit difficult once it starts getting dark to find people. So having been a guest, you will now become the chaser for me of other guests. And I'll bung on a couple of tunes for you whilst we sort out what's going to happen next. It's quite dark in here. Dark Wolf coming up next himself, and we're going to have a bit of talk about power stations and what he's doing here. In the meantime, here's Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths and Needs Must When the Devil Drives. CC Smugglers there, and their tune Lydia off Write What You Know, and before that Dexter Dextrous, and we're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on Raconteurs News. We're coming to you live from the Conscious Tribal Gathering in Glyndebourne, where I am happy to say I'm joined by Dark Wolf, who's hosting the show tonight for us. Thanks, Dark Wolf.
Hey, you're welcome. Nice to be here.
Brilliant. And what are you doing at the festival then?
I'm teaching people to make pendants out of old coins.
And they are really nice little things. You're kind of cutting away the bits that aren't designed. It looks like it'd take ages. How long does it take you to turn one out?
It depends. I mean, a very simple one's about an hour and a half, but I've done a flower of life into a coin that took me 10 hours to cut out. So mostly 2.5 hours or less for most of them.
And then you're running little workshops that people can come and have a go themselves.
Yeah, there's 6 designs. There's some easy ones just to get some sword practice so you can actually make your own pendant and take something away that you've made, and then the skill that you've acquired as well, which is, pass on the skills as much as possible, really.
And you've got loads of little things there. There's geometry, there's beautiful pictures of trees with hearts on them and coins and all manner of stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's 6 years of apprenticeship to get this far.
And here you are teaching people to do it in a field for free. Are you sure you're not endangering your profession?
No, not really, because it's 6 years of practice. Go ahead.
fair enough. And I suspect like everybody that's gathering in this field, you've got your own activist interests. And I know one of the first things you brought up with me was the fact that Hinkley Point appears to have been given the go-ahead for another power station. So do you think that's the end of the game?
No, no, not at all. We've got a decade. I mean, they're planning on building this thing in a decade. And I know that we can, as an organisation, as people who come and know that nuclear power is just not an answer to any question, any sensible question, does not end up with you going nuclear power, you know. And one of the things that annoys me that gets away with in the media is the fact that they talk about it as sort of carbon neutral, but then they ignore how much carbon is involved in the actual building of the nuclear power station and the decommissioning of the fuel rods, if we could ever actually do that, yeah. You know, and what's the cost of a site that's going to be poisonous to the human race for a million years?
It makes me spit when people describe nuclear power stations as carbon neutral, and I think that it's one of the biggest demonstrations that the carbon thing, whether it's right or wrong, is a distraction.
Yeah, it is a distraction because there's nothing coming out of the top of it. You know, there's no sort of dark smoke coming out, so they can pretend that it's carbon neutral. But then go and look how much concrete actually goes into making this thing, yeah. You know, and then how much carbon is actually fixed in all the concrete. The embodied energy, so the entire energy involved in making a nuclear power station over any other form, pales into insignificance when you look at the whole thing.
I think another thing that really startled me about the carbon sequestration stuff is that when I was looking into the One Planet Development Policy, one of the things they really want you to keep track of is your carbon footprint. Now, apparently it's very easy to stay inside the current targets. But the thing about it is that in order to do One Planet Development, you have to be running a commercial venture. There has to be a return on capital, so you've got to be doing subsist. But they only measure for your carbon footprint, they only measure your domestic fuel and stuff like that. They're not interested in the commercial thing. I read the guide notes and I looked at that and I thought, well, if you're not going to be doing it on the commercial side, what the hell's the point?
Yeah, that's true. Take back to Hinkley Point, though, because that's kind of where we started this conversation. And to be honest, I think there's some other tactics, that not just the blocking of the roads using human beings to do so, but, you know, this is potentially the use of something like a seed bomb containing a plant that will grow up through concrete. You know, they can be fired onto the site, because if suddenly Japanese knotweed is growing up all over Hinkley Point, then the whole thing becomes a farce for them, because they're going to have to dig up millions of pounds worth of concrete and put it back. You know, this is a point where we need different tactics to deal with this, because they won't listen to us. They won't listen about poisoning so many generations into the future. And we're looking at Fukushima. You know, you've only got, as an environmentalist, all you've got to end anything with is Fukushima, because we don't have the technology to deal with Fukushima now. And actually, there are people saying that they don't see in the foreseeable future we have the technology to deal with Fukushima. So why are we building more of these monstrosities? And to be honest, the gloves are off when it comes to these sorts of things. You know, we've got enough problems with nuclear power. We've got enough problems. It's time to actually take the gloves off and actually stop this thing going ahead. You know, and the French don't think it's viable. We had another resignation of a board member. We've lost the finance director of EDF, and we've lost another board member, and the union's against it. I mean, they're against it more because of EDF as a business is bankrupt. Yeah, we're taking Chinese money using a French firm who's bankrupt to build a power station that's going to be toxic for how long on our shores? It doesn't make any sense at all.
How did they get... Sorry, Sue, do you want to... you need to have the mic. You need to have it quite close to you.
Okay. Yeah, unless you take Agenda 21 into consideration, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
And, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, I think it makes total sense.
But even with Agenda 21, but nuclear power station doesn't make sense because of the again, look at Fukushima, look at what Fukushima's doing to the Pacific Ocean,
I think there are technologies that will deal with nuclear waste.
Are we going to have time? Look at Fukushima.
No, the technologies already exist, they're just not being used because they want to roll out Agenda 21 program.
The thing, I'd agree with the Agenda 21 thing, except that they're after reducing the Earth's population by 80%, not by all of it.
Agreed. But, I mean, take a look at Chernobyl. Life is returning there. And, okay, I'm not... It's But I think there are other factors as well. There are energy. One of
the really interesting things that came out of Chernobyl was the fact that they found that if they grow certain fungi, they can clean nuclear waste material from the ground and actually sterilize the ground using fungi.
Yeah.
Of all the things that's happening in the world at the moment, it seems that a light is being shown finally in the right place of the network that actually communicates life to all things that we don't think necessarily communicate, and fungi are amazing things, but I'm not sure that we're going to be able to save the world using fungi.
There is evidence of nuclear weaponry being used on this planet before. If you look into the ancient mythology, you know, the Mahabharata and stories like that, the myths, you know, those kinds of myths, there is evidence. There is evidence that nuclear weaponry has been used on this planet, and it is, you know, and I think they understand.
Show it. There's certainly ground in India and places where, you know, it's been melted, and the only explanation that they can come up with is a nuclear explosion of some description.
Yeah.
So how did these guys get away? How did they get this decision to build this nuclear plant? And was it a, you know, a public, full, clear, open public consultation, or did they just did?
behind
I thought not. I kind of thought not somehow.
But again, you see, one of the things that is trumpeted about this is like 25,000 jobs are going to be created building this monstrosity. Who gives a hell?
Free energy, you know? Technology, loads of jobs created.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's an interesting project off of Perth where they've actually put sort of turbines in the currents.
Yeah.
And they're just making power for fun. You know, and we've got the technology to not have nuclear. The only reason we got nuclear power is again the money that's involved in it and who actually makes money out of it, and the ability to make nuclear weapons, which hopefully these idiots who control them are never going to use, because
they have every intention of using them, in my opinion, because of Agenda 21, and you know they want to create order out of the chaos that they're creating. And nuclear weapons, they're already using nuclear weapons. Take a look at depleted uranium in
depleted in what sense?
We've
had it 50 years. Yeah, but the half-life's 50,000. Yeah, but we'll call it depleted, and then we can get away
precisely
with using it.
I can see where you're coming from on that one, Souk, but I think we've got to recognise that actually several of their recent plots at creating war and getting people to fight each other and stuff have actually fallen pretty much flat on their face, and it does seem that people themselves are becoming far more aware of this sort of thing, and when push comes to shove, they are going to need people who can push the buttons. I really do think that
I'm just wondering whether, you know, the shit has to hit the fan before that happens, you know, because take a look at all the wars they've created. I mean, they are still going ahead with their programs, regardless of how much pushback we're creating. And it is still a small minority that's awake to and aware of the agenda, the bigger agenda. And until more of us become aware and realize that we are being used as pawns in a much bigger game, you know, the grand chessboard is Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yeah. Well, that's actually precisely why I'm here this year, is because I've got a bit tired of that, and I've put together a talk which I hope is going to be addressable just to normal people. I mean, it's pretty extreme. Tells them that laws don't necessarily apply to them. Tells them that we're policed by consent. Tells them what money is and where it comes from. Just to leave them with the decision, because ultimately all of these things need men and women to run them. And what we need to be doing is, just a few people decided on that power station. There must have been hardly anybody involved in that decision.
I can't remember. I mean, it was held locally, so it was, I mean, some of them were just overcrowded with people because they chose small venues, you know, deliberately small venues so that people didn't have a voice, you know. And, I mean, it's been in planning for how long, Hinckley? And now they've taken a decision to start go ahead. But, you know, this... France is tearing itself to pieces at the moment. We can only hope that it carries on tearing itself to pieces and EDF goes down the pan, because EDF should be gone down the pan.
Yeah.
And they're talking about the one they're building in northern France somewhere at the moment is already, twice over its budget? Mm. There's no guarantee that they'll actually complete Hinckley Point to the costs that they've said that they will. And then even if they do, we've already agreed to pay twice the cost that we're currently paying for electricity from Hinkley already.
Yeah.
So that, you know, by building Hinkley Point, we're going to double the price of our electricity. So we're going to have a monstrosity on our shores that may not even work. This particular reactor is a bit dodgy from what I've heard.
And as you've said, given the way things are going, we would actually be far better off using Schauberger's technology and getting our water from the getting our power from the waters.
No, totally, yeah. Totally. That we should be following those sorts of things. I mean, Schauberger's Trout turbine, for every unit of energy he put in the top, he was getting 50,000 units of energy out the bottom, which apparently, according to physics, is impossible. But you know, he made Popoff do that experiment where he was getting negative friction. Now, I understand positive friction is loss of energy. So surely negative friction then is a production of energy. And his problem was actually controlling the amount of energy he was creating, because every single Trout turbine he built blew up.
Yeah,
he's an absolutely amazing guy, one of my very few heroes, along with Tesla. And again, Tesla, all of the Tesla's work. You know, we've got new renewables in wind power, but Tesla's means of generating and producing electricity, because it didn't make the elite money, it got buried.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't bury everything forever, you know.
I hear rumours actually that the certain aspects of Tesla's technologies are being used by the power generation companies.
The Russians have just spent a lot of money building a whole series of Tesla towers. So, I mean, if nobody else, the Russians are prepared to take it on.
One of the things that struck me about Tesla is he did really like the really big boys' toys and stuff, and that Schauberger's stuff is really beautifully elegant and simple.
Beautiful, and it follows nature as well, because the actual spiral that Schauberger uses is a Fibonacci spiral, and because of the way that it twists the water, there's no friction on the sides. Popoff found that in that spiral, when he was monitoring flow against friction on the side, that at certain flow rates in a Fibonacci spiral you were getting negative friction, and that's power.
That's power, folks. Not the stuff they're telling us is power. Just in case you're wondering.
You know, spun, which is what it wants to do. It becomes alive. Yeah. You know, most of the water that people are drinking through the, you know, through the copper pipes and stuff is effectively dead water. Mm. And again, you know, the experiments that Schauberger and other people have done, where they've put water through a Fibonacci spiral and then grown things from it, compared to, you know, most of what we, you know, tap water, the differences are amazing. Just amazing.
Bringing your water back alive, checking out the mushrooms a few more. And we certainly don't need to be building nukes. I mean, it seems to me that we could easily be getting loads more power elsewhere. Well, that's really great. You've done your 20 minutes. Oh, thank really? You. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks very much for joining us. And I'll let you in.
But different tactics. We need to be more like Earth first, because ultimately what we have to live on is the Earth. And if we don't do more Earth first type tactics, where we are prepared to put ourselves on the line for Mother, because we can't live anywhere else. I don't know anybody who can go and live on Mars or the Moon or anywhere like that. And, you know, when we're talking about fracking and we're talking about nuclear technology, the gloves have to come off. We have to put ourselves more on the line, and we have to use cleverer tactics, you know, not just demonstrations, you know, not weeds, spiky jacks on roads which do tires in, all those sorts of things to slow them down, because the only thing these people understand is money. And if the shareholders are not making enough money from their investment because it's taken 15 years to build Hinkley Point, let's make it take 15 years to build Hinkley Point.
And as we say, in over 15 years you could drone a lot of Japanese knotweed. I mean,
because it grows up through concrete, and they have to take the concrete away.
They do. It turns the entire site into hazardous waste and causes them a whole load of trouble, basically. Not that we'd, of course, be even.
We don't applaud that at all.
Because we haven't got. Nature will ultimately win. Well, thank you very much, Dark Wolf, for the place to broadcast from and for joining us and chatting with us. We do appreciate it. No, it's great, Sook. Sook's coming up next, and we're going to be. What are we going to be talking about after a couple of tunes, Sook?
Whatever you want to talk about.
Brilliant. I've got carte blanche, folks. So whilst we get that sorted out, we'll come up with another couple of quick tunes for you. What's next? Oh yeah, Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles, a great tune. And we're not in the fast lane here, we're definitely in the slow lane. Back with you in about 7 minutes. Thanks for being there, folks. Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. I've got it right 3 times in a row. Elvis versus JXL there, and a little less conversation, a little more action, please. What do you reckon, Souk?
It's definitely time for action. Definitely.
It certainly is. Well, we've in the gap there, in that little 7 minutes of tunes, we've covered a hell of a lot of subjects. So, but I'm interested in your David Icke Wake the World t-shirt. What's going on there?
What's going on? Okay. I guess, like for many people, 9/11 was a big wake-up call for me. And when I started researching it, looking into, you know, how 9/11 could even happen, let alone happen, you know, there were so many questions that I had that were just not being answered by the mainstream media. And I followed the mainstream media like a zombie. And, you know, for a good few years, I watched even Al Jazeera in Arabic, trying to think that, you know, thinking that I might glean something from, you know, what this attack was all about. And it wasn't until I watched a documentary called 9/11 Mysteries, mm-hmm. Which totally blew my mind. And once you realize, you know, I've got an engineering degree and a physics background. And just looking at the way those towers came down just did not make any sense to me. I mean, let alone anything else. You know, the idea that those two massive blocks of towers can just disintegrate in a matter of seconds just did not compute.
I was with you there because we used to spend a lot of time with my parents watching and listening to a character called Blaster Bates, who's a comedian who specialises in controlled demolition of buildings. Nice pair of kind of like... a nice pair of things that he did. So I'd already watched loads of controlled demolitions of all sorts of things, and as soon as I saw it, I don't think you have to be an architect or an engineer.
No, that's very interesting you should say that, because I had watched controlled demolitions before, but for some stupid reason, and I cannot figure out why, I did not make the connection that it was a controlled demolition, because I still bought into the, you know, the whole terrorist angle. Mm. You know, and, you know, figured that there must have been a legitimate reason for why this happened. And until I watched that 9/11 Mysteries, and that sort of blew my mind. And, you know, at that point, I became really, really fearful because, you know, to recognize the fact that somebody, you know, a country, a government could go and do that to its own people on such a massive scale and then lie about it on such a huge scale, you know, made you realize that, well, I did feel powerless at that time. And it's taken me a long while, you know, it's been an ongoing journey since then.
I would guess that before the great going away of buildings, you'd probably spotted other things and just kind of shrugged them and looked away. That's what it was like for a lot of us. And really, those other things that you'd spotted also come into focus at that moment, don't they? So it's really quite a big rush.
It is. I mean, JFK for one, Diana another. Yeah. You know, the list is endless when you start thinking about it. Yeah. But those are the big ones that come to mind immediately. And even in my own, you know, profession, I worked as an IT consultant in the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, I thought I was doing something really, really good to help humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously healthcare, everybody's interested in that. It's important to be healthy and what have you. Yeah. And while I had some niggling doubts in the back of my mind about how this business model could work, if it, you know, if you're making people healthy, then the pharmaceutical industry goes out of business, and, you know, how does that work? But I never really questioned it too deeply because I was enjoying the the rewards of the industry.
Which is steady pay, reliable job, and all that kind of stuff. What would you say were the first cracks that started appearing in the pharmaceutical argument for you?
Well, my parents, both of them, one after the other, suffered from cancer. And with 9/11, recognizing what a lie that was, it just opened the door for everything else, whether it was health, law, environmental issues, I don't know. Everything, basically, was turned upside down on its head. And what amazes me today is that everything I look at, you turn it 180 degrees in the opposite direction, and that's where you'll find the truth.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, when I'm talking to people who are kind of just getting out on this path, I say to them, if you know nothing and you assume that everything is about roughly the opposite of whatever it is you're being told, and take that as the truth, you'll have a much better rule of thumb than watching the telly.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, as I said earlier, I religiously watched the mainstream media, whether it was Question Time, Newsnight, news channels, Arabic news, you name it. Anything that I thought was a source of information, even documentaries, Fahrenheit 9/11, you know, yeah. All of those. I religiously watched those thinking, you know, they're going to finally give me the answers. And guess what? The mainstream media is a total crock of baloney.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? That, I mean, basically, people that in your previous state you would have regarded as being experts, say, on the economy. The economy is one of my favourites because the people who are talking about the economy either don't know what they're talking about or they're not telling me. And the basic conclusion from that and the great going away and buildings and stuff is that they are all, every single one of them, either patsies or frauds. So they either know what's going on and they're a fraud, or they don't know what's going on and they're a patsy.
Or useful idiots.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk to economists and bankers and, you know, anybody in the financial institution, and I say, where does money come from? And, you know, it used to be that I'd get more satisfaction out of banging my head against a brick wall than talking to these people.
Yeah.
But now, you know, you tell them it's, you know, the bankers create it out of thin air, and they accept that. But they don't seem to make the connection that, hey, the economy is still fraudulent because somebody can create money out of thin air and, you know, dictate the future of a country or the world, the planet. And was it Mayor Ramshaw Rothschild who said, give me the power to control, you know, print, make money, and I don't care who's on the throne,
yeah.
You know, because obviously he has more power than anybody else. And I'm coming to the conclusion that money is only a spin-off benefit that these people have. It's more about control and power, and I think they realize that, you know, their fraud is being exposed, which is partly why I think they want to reduce the global population. You know.
I think the timing's not accidental. We've got Freeman Jacks just put in, ignorant or complicit, neither being a lawful excuse. Which I really like. You know, that's... The answer I get quite often to the money thing, because you explain to people, well, look, when you buy a house for 100 grand, for a start off, you create the 100 grand and give it to them, and they steal it and put it in their books and then pretend to lend it to you, and then you have to pay them 240%, say, but they stole it in the first place. So you're paying £360,000 or something, and they're taking the money and making shitloads out of it. And do you know what they thought? The number of people who said, well, you have to have a system, and this is the system we've got. It's like the massive inertia, but it does seem to me that that's changing now.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, I think one of the people who's doing a really good job in exposing that is Michael Tellinger, who's done a fabulous job. And the nice thing about what he's done is he's offering a credible alternative.
This is the Ubuntu gift economy, isn't it?
Yep, contributionism. So, you know, everything I've looked at, you know, I had a little bit of problem getting my head around this before, you know, because you start thinking about, you know, some kind of value exchange, barter, and things like that. And then once you finally overcome that hurdle, you realize, hey, we actually have everything on this planet right now, the know-how, the technology, everything to create heaven on earth, and money is not required.
No. Well, I mean, like I said to the ladies in the building society the other day, I said, thanks, Her Majesty's finest promises to pay, promissory tokens. And they looked at me and I said, well, it says promise to pay, doesn't it? Yeah. And I don't think they'd noticed. They have to count it out twice before they give it to you. They have to count it out themselves. And even if you say, yeah, I watched you doing it, it's all right, I can see, they still have to count it out again. But they hadn't noticed that it said a promise to pay on it. And I looked at them and I said, and we don't intend to pay, do we?
Yeah,
and you can see the kind of, there is a kind of glimmer of realisation there then, but the thing is, we do go to the co-op, we do pick up 100 quid's worth of groceries, and we don't have a pay.
So we don't have money anyway.
No, we could just... It's, yeah, yeah. And it seems to me that that things work a lot better when we're trading. I've realised that when we're trading and bartering, and when we're working for not for gaming tokens, when I'm doing things that I do for gaming tokens, not for gaming tokens, I really enjoy the latter much more.
Mm. And I think when you do something, you know, from your heart, you do it that much better. You know, you enjoy doing it, so you make sure you do it to the best of your ability. Mm. Whereas, you know, if you're going out to earn these tokens, as you put it, you know, your heart's not in it. You're just doing it. You're just, you know, going. I know that the job I did, I was only doing it because the money that I was getting at the end of the day, so I could do the things that I liked, which was flying, skiing, hiking, scuba diving, and all that.
So, and do you still do all of that stuff, or have you? I mean, presumably, like all of us, you inevitably end up modifying your life, don't you? You have to do things differently once you've discovered the fraud.
Oh, I've had to modify my life big time, and to be honest, you know, it's in a good way. I still get to, you know, go skiing, hiking, but I don't have that freedom of being able to go when I used to be able to go, you know, because that wasn't one of my problems. It's like, you know, I'd have to save up a lot harder and, you know, and think about where I'm spending my money that I do have now, because I don't work now. I've deliberately chosen to stay out of the corporate world. Mm-hmm. I don't want to support the Babylonian, you know, slave system anymore. And I think this is the important message for me. If I was to put out a message to anybody, is the only reason they can do what they do to us is because we go along with their program. And once we stop doing that, they have no power at all.
One of the reasons why, one of the main reasons we're going along with their program is because they hide it really, really well, and most people don't realize they are, but they're starting to. My feeling was that the Brexit fiasco, although it didn't actually reveal any useful information at all in the debate, as far as I could tell, for the reasons we've outlined previously, it has resulted in a kind of political awakening. And we know that politics is not just the left and right, not just the Houses of Parliament. Politics is what the people are doing. Mm. And I think they stuck 240,000 volts up a global system.
I'm not too sure. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure of exactly what Brexit was about, because who called
for
who called for the referendum to begin with, and who got us into the EU or the European Union in the first place? I mean, they didn't have a referendum to get us in, so why did they want a referendum to get us, you know, to vote whether we're in or out? So that's an interesting question for me. I think it's more about testing the water. I think it's more about seeing where the public is on, you know, their agenda to bring about a single world government, you know, a single currency.
I just really didn't see any evidence at all that any of them were expecting the result they got.
I think you're right. They probably didn't, because I think they're scrambling now, because, you know, they have absolutely no intention of exiting.
I think we'd agree with that.
You know, they're bringing up, Article 50, is it? Brilliant. And, you know, and they're delaying it by 2 years, and they'll find another excuse. And I heard that the you know, some lawyers have said that Parliament has to make the final decision, and they don't have to listen to the people.
I tend to agree. I'd say the most obvious evidence that we are not going to leave is that Theresa May said that we definitely weren't going to have a second referendum, which can only mean that we are, because they only lie.
Well, yeah. I mean, take a look at what happened in Ireland.
The tapping of the foot, and we can spend all day here. It's only your own time you're wasting.
The sooner you say yes, the sooner this will be over.
I just don't think it's actually going to be there 2 years from now. Anyway, what we got? We saw in the chat box, Nick Nomix put in, ask an economist a question, and often the answer starts, it's complicated, which is quite true. I studied economics at
A-level. No. It's a very, very simple, once you understand where money comes from and how it's being used against
us. It's basically a matter of convert it into stealables, then steal it as fast as you can.
That's it. I mean, take a look at quantitative easing, what it's all that about.
There is no economic model, folks. There isn't even a rumour of an economic model when you look at it. And they do say it's complicated, but basically economics is about saying, if variables A through W do not exist, then X plus Y equals Z.
The truth is always simple. It really is.
I remember being taught that that supply and demand determined prices, but the prices were inflexible downwards. How can that be? You know, please explain. So are you finding, since you've kind of ditched the corporate life, which a lot of us have done, are you finding that the environment and people are throwing up opportunities that are keeping you busy and entertained?
Yeah, definitely. I did get involved in politics at one point, setting up a neighborhood.
Was that successful?
No. You very quickly realize that, you know, it doesn't matter what you want or what you say or what you care about, you know, the government agenda goes ahead, and all you have is just a talking shop where, you know, you're allowed to vent your frustrations, but they're going to still do what they want to do.
Yeah, there's some people paid to be the opposition. There's some people paid not to be the opposition, but they're all being paid out of the same purse, so they're therefore all the same thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
You are who pays you.
That's it, exactly. And I, you know, once I started you know, people used to say to me, why don't you go into politics if you care about this? And, you know, through my experience with the forum, I realized that was a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's interesting that, again, going back to Michael, he's setting up the Ubuntu Party.
Yeah.
And, okay, he's going the political route, but I think that's more to undermine the politics and sort of expose it for what it really is.
Yeah. I guess somebody's got to do it. I mean, we know that registering your vote is giving it away. You're the registered keeper of your vote, just like you're the registered keeper of the car. But I can see why people like Tallinger are going for the political option, because it seems to be the only way of attracting people's attention.
Well, I think this is the way you can get to a wider audience in the mainstream media, because now, you know, if you're doing anything outside of the mainstream media, outside of the mainstream sort of thinking, you're not going to get the kind of coverage that you deserve. So I think this is one way of sort of getting that coverage or getting that exposure and undermining the politics for what it really, well, not even undermining it, it's exposing it for what it really is.
Yeah. And replacing it with the real thing, yeah. Basically. And that means, like Simon Spaniard says, that the point of government that's missing is us, because we're supposed to be holding it to account. Mm. So ultimately, that's really good news, because it means what every single one of us does counts.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was Einstein that said, you cannot solve a problem with the level of consciousness that created the problem. And Buckminster Fuller said, create a new model that makes the old model obsolete. And, you know, this is something that I think is absolutely perfect, with what the Ubuntu program, you know, project is doing.
Yeah.
And I often say that if we sort of married permaculture principles with Ubuntu, I think we'd be pretty close to having a very beautiful planet to live on.
Yeah. And I think it's true to say as well that when you do give up the corporate lifestyle, it gives you time to start doing things for people, because you've got the time to do them. And that what I see coming back is also the stuff doesn't come back necessarily from the person you've been out and helped out. It sometimes comes back from somebody else. Oh, but the one way or the other, it does come back to you.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, living on next to nothing now, you know, you find that people do have the same, you know, compassion, the same sort of, you know, people do want to, we are social creatures at the end of the day, and we do thrive in society, and, you know, we do want to work together. And I think, you know, Conscious Tribal Gathering is an excellent example of that. You know, you come here and people will, you know, meet and greet and share and what have you with everyone. So I think, you know, it's naturally happening, but I also see like a division happening as well, where there is this expanded awareness in the human consciousness, but at the same time, more and more people are getting further and further trapped in the matrix as well. So yeah, there does seem to be a division, a polarization.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. But Do you know, people are changing. I think that I think we're in for some really exciting times, personally.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I can't think of a better time to be alive.
No, I'd agree with that. Well, thanks very much for joining us on the radio show, Souk. It's always good to talk to you.
Likewise. Great to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm gonna play another couple of tunes, then we have another guest coming up. Who's a surprise guest, I think, so we'll find out what that's about. And yes, indeed, folk, they got the police and judges in their back pocket. Justice is gone. Wake up from Dinny in the chat box. I couldn't agree more with you, Dinny. That's absolutely the way it is. But fortunately, I think people are responding to the cause. Arrested for driving while blind by ZZ Top. Who indeed could be so unkind? And we're Dr. Rock's radio show coming to you live from the Conscious Tribal Gathering, where I'm joined by Jamie, who's very bravely come along with his crew of people to do the food for the weekend. Thanks, Jamie, for the show and the food, mate.
Okay, no problem. Good evening.
It's really great to have you here, and the food so far has been totally brilliant. Boy, am I looking forward to spending 3 days in a field with you. Have you always done the catering, or you sort of grown into it?
It's something I've kind of come into over the last few years. A few friends and I started doing pop-up cafes at the Conwy Food Festival, North Wales. And this is just like a sort of once a year thing. There's this big food festival in Conwy, and we would sort of hire a venue and run a vegan cafe in it, just on sort of donations. Just with the view of kind of promoting, you know, a vegan lifestyle and sort of showing people what's possible and that it's not all just brown sludge and that kind of thing. And yeah, it's kind of come from that, and we've picked up a few other gigs between us. So we just did the Better Sacoid Christmas Fair this year, just gone. We sort of do a few other gigs a year now. But this is certainly the first time catering at a big festival like this.
Right, well, I think you're probably going to do really well. And I mean, it seems to me you've got a small team there. You seem to be very relaxed and have it, and it's really quite basic as well. It's not like you've got to shed loads of tackle in there.
No, not really. No, we're just sort of working on gas hobs and a few big pans, and I brought along a bit of stuff that I prepared earlier, so we've got a few cakes and things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we're keeping it fairly simple, and so doing sort of salads and mezze stuff at lunchtime, and then you know, a big pan full of curry and stuff in the evening.
Absolutely perfect. Like I said, I really hate aubergine, and you gave us aubergine and cauliflower curry tonight, which was really, really brilliant.
Well, good to be of service.
So, veganism, you always been a vegan, or did you start off like the rest of us with depraved dietary habits?
Well, I'm from an omnivorous family, so I'm 28 now, and I was brought up eating some meat until I was sort of, I think it was 7 or 8, I went veggie. And you know, my family weren't massive carnivores. They sort of ate a pretty good diet, and you know, probably eat meat a few times a week. It was kind of every day.
Yeah.
But I think just even at like 7, 8, I guess I was from the countryside, and sort of had farm animals around, and just what I was exposed to, kind of what meat was and where it came from. And I think it's sort of, as I understood that, it was a very simple kind of reaction at 7 or 8 that I just didn't like killing animals. So,
So what do you think is the most important thing that we need to bear in mind? If we're not going to eat animals, what do we need to be eating that's going to keep us healthy and bright-eyed like you obviously are?
Well, thank you. There's an ongoing debate raging about sort of what people need to eat to be healthy and thrive. I mean, most of the more kind of orthodox view says that, you know, we've evolved on an omnivorous diet for, you know, most of our evolutionary history. And I think, you know, bearing that in mind, you've got to make sure you're getting things like B12, omega-3, perhaps vitamin D in the winter, which you'd normally get from sort of animal products in your diet. Yeah. But if you're just on plants, you don't tend to get naturally occurring sources of those in a plant diet. So sort of things like most soy milks and Marmite and sort of yeast extracts particularly will have a lot of B12 in them.
Yeah.
So just a matter of kind of making sure you've got that sort of stuff in your diet, and yeah. And just eating a ton of fruit and veg at every opportunity. You know, just loads of fruit and veg is great. And,
yeah.
I think the common question people ask is kind of protein. Yeah, how do you get enough protein? And I think if you're getting enough food to kind of be healthy, you know, it's generally not really an issue in my experience. I mean, yeah. I don't worry too much about protein. I'm fairly strong. I go and do a bit of weights at gym and stuff. So,
what about the B12? Because that's quite difficult to come across, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, some people do seem to do fine without an obvious dietary source of B12. Now, sort of in kind of ruminant animals, it's coming from bacteria in their rumen's digestive system. And possibly some humans have got those bacteria in their own digestive systems, so are able to produce it. But certainly a lot of people aren't. I mean, I've got vegan friends who've sort of become B12 deficient and had to start taking a supplement.
Yeah.
And it's worth watching out for, because you can do yourself some serious damage if you don't address it.
Yeah.
And it takes a few years to show up. So.
How does it show up?
Initially, sort of tiredness and anemia. If you have a blood test, you'd come out as anemic.
Right.
And just sort of feeling washed out and tired all the time. If it gets to a really advanced, severe stage, you start to get muscle tremors, sort of psychological symptoms, like, you know, anxiety. And and by that point, you're sort of looking at doing permanent nerve damage. So that's why it can be pretty nasty, and it's something to definitely be aware of.
And can we get that, any of that from our food?
Yeah, well, as I say, kind of your vegan sources of that, B12 is added to a lot of... I mean, a lot of vegans don't eat a lot of processed food, but... So, I mean, sort of processed foods will have it added, like, you know, margarines and soy milks and things, and breakfast cereals and all sort of have it in. If you know, like me, you're not eating a lot of that stuff anyway, then I mean, I get most of mine personally from sort of yeast extract. Yeah. A kind of Meridian yeast extract has it added at quite a high level.
Okay.
So there's plenty in that. And you can take a supplement pill as well if you want to, but I think I get through enough of my Meridian yeast extract. I don't need to worry about it too much. And I give a blood donation every 4 months and always come up fine in that. So no sign of anemia. So that's my barometer on it.
Excellent stuff. And as you've been doing sort of more catering out and about, are you finding that you're meeting new and interesting people, getting more opportunities? You find it's disengaging you from the standard business world a bit?
I mean I've sort of pretty much disengaged myself from a lot of the standard business world anyway, but with sort of picking up catering work. And so I work in a vegan restaurant in Bangor, just opened. It's called Volta, very nice. And just started picking up a bit of work at a yoga center, doing catering there. And sort of you get to meet a lot of interesting people, and it's great sort of getting to chat to people about this, because particularly like in the Voltaire, this vegan restaurant in Bangor, a lot of the people who come in there are not vegans already. They're just sort of they're curious to see what it's like, and so they've got a lot of questions, and it's great to chat with them.
Yeah, I know, the better by and large. I mean, I think that when people do encounter vegetarian or vegan food, in my experience, they tend to enjoy it a lot more than they might expect to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my kind of strategy with doing these things has often been not to kind of drive home the vegan thing too much. Like, I'll just cook good food and sell it, and people will come along.
That's what we do too.
Yeah, and then they might realise after a while, hang on, there's no animal stuff in this, and but it's actually all right. Having said that, I mean, like this, the new vegan restaurant in Bangor is quite upfront about being a vegan restaurant, and it's working for them. It's working really well because, as I say, people are curious.
Yeah.
They want to see what it's all about.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and hopefully they'll be suitably rewarded. I remember taking my dad for the first time ever to the Royal Oak Cafe in Llanidloes, which is a whole food cafe. So it doesn't do meat, it does do cheese, and it is. He'd never been to one before, and he was completely stunned by the quality of the food, because, of course, certain class of society is used to only getting good food when they pay shed loads of cash for it. But if you do go to vegan and whole food cafes, you can be really surprised, in my experience.
Yeah, I mean, sort of vegan food is inherently cheaper. I mean, if you're using a lot of things like vegan cheese and stuff, it can be quite expensive, but you don't need to. And I mean, I think I've never met a vegan who eats a lot of that kind of stuff anyways.
No. And do you grow any? I know you say you garden. Do you grow any of your own food?
Yeah, I do try. I mean, this year I've moved around a lot in the last this year, so I haven't got a lot going on at the moment. But yeah, on and off, I it waxes and wanes, and sometimes I grow quite a lot, and sometimes not so much.
Yeah, indeed, it's a matter of time, isn't it? But doesn't it taste better when you do grow it yourself?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You can pick things when they're ready to be picked, rather than when they need to be picked to transport them and that kind of thing. And just grow for quality rather than quantity. So.
Absolutely right, yeah, I think that's a good hint. We generally go grow one for yourself, one for the slugs, and one to give away.
Sounds good, yeah.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you very much, Jamie, for joining us for that. It's really great to talk to you, and I'll catch up with you again, obviously, quite often.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to meeting some of the listeners over the next few days.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, hopefully we're going to do this again on Saturday night. We'll do a bonus show, but thanks very much for joining us. I really appreciate that. And for the listeners out there, that was Jamie, who and him and his team are doing all the cooking here, which is I'm really looking forward to. As you know, I need good food if I'm going to be lively crew. So I'm going to put on one more tune, and then we've got a bonus guest. Is Pete Howard still here?
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. So we have another surprise guest before the end of the show. So here's a 2.5 minute Yellow song. This is Bananas to the Beat. Go for it. Get those dancing shoes on and turn it up. Ah, one of the Doctor's favourite bands there, Kidnap Alice and Fitz, which Hippie Joe, who authored it, tells me stands for Farting in the Sink. So here we are, we've got the last 15 minutes or so to go. We'll have 10 minutes of chat with a total surprise guest, Pete Howard. Pete, thanks very much for joining me.
You're welcome, Nick. How are you doing?
Very good indeed, thank you very much. And we've never met before. Here we are sitting in a dark tent on top of a hill. What do you think we should talk about?
Well, with that last tune I heard, I just imagine people going around chasing Pokemon.
Oh, God, yeah, Pokemongo. It took me a while to work out what that was.
But no, it's been good here. I got here yesterday, and it's lots of people have turned up today. This is the main day, the start. And, I'm really enjoying myself, and it's been good. And, we're here till, I think, Monday, so it's only Thursday, so we've got a few more days to go.
That's right, yeah, there's plenty of stuff going on out there already, and it doesn't officially start till tomorrow, I don't think. But have you had a chance to have a look at a schedule?
A little bit of a look. A couple of people have, I'm not sure if the guy's doing the talk on the Pain Genie. I'm not sure if that's happening. Is that happening?
There was a Pain Genie last year. I don't know whether he's coming again.
I missed the Pain Genie, yeah. That was interesting, that, because I couldn't make it last year because I had a bad accident and couldn't get here for last year's festival. So this year I've made it, and yeah, I'm having a good time, so...
Yeah, that sometimes happens, doesn't it? Sometimes it's just not quite the right year. Doesn't sound like a Pain Genie would help. What did you do to yourself?
Well, I fractured my shoulder pretty bad, so, yeah, I was in a bit of a mess for about 3 or 4 months, so... Yeah.
Well, I think... I think he came along and he was actually operating kind of like... he was working with Clive DeCarl in a kind of tent a bit like this there was quite a lot of activity.
Yeah.
So... I know you're part of the what they're calling the new media, but we anticipate ourselves becoming the mainstream. What is it that you're? What is it that you do?
Well, I say 5 years ago, I did a few little shows. I think I did something called Resistance Radio years ago. I got involved with them. That didn't work out in the end, and then Flipping the Pyramid. I don't know if anyone's heard of Flipping the Pyramid.
Well, I don't remember Flipping the Pyramid. What did they do? That's a great name, great name.
That was a website. A group of us got together and we were doing basic radio shows and just, again, discussing what's going on in, you know, geopolitical and also slightly maybe esoteric as well, if it was my show or whatever. So, and that went for about a year. And then we jumped over to the Google Beast came along, and we jumped into the Hangouts, and I've been doing a reality chat in there for about 4 years.
All right, so you've actually been at the sort of pretty much at the cutting edge then, because internet radio and stuff like that 5-6 years ago, it wasn't common.
No, I mean, we've kept going. I got into this, and I was really passionate about, you know, speaking out and talking about what's really going on, and I've got some spiritual background as well, so, you know, I've that helps me. Because you've got to get your head screwed on when you're dealing with all this information, and you've got to get yourself grounded and balanced, and because it sends people crazy, it can do, and we've seen that, and we see that a lot.
Yeah, it is an interesting question that I found myself wondering about it, because with the Truth Juice and everything and the radio work, I do notice that everybody who starts encountering the true nature of the beast, as it were, tends to find themselves really rapidly on a spiritual path, and we find ourselves wondering whether... which way round it is, whether it's people who are on a spiritual path tend to start uncovering the rabbit hole, or whether you find yourself actually on a path that you weren't. What was it? I think it's got to be a mixture, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was 2003 that things started to change for me, when spiritual doorways started to open and I started to develop myself and think, yeah, this is something that was always with me.
So was it spirituality before conspiracy for you?
Yeah. Well, it was always... Well, I always question things. Yeah. And, yeah, I've always been like that all my life. I've always questioned.
Yeah.
And I always thought the government was all bullshit, even when I was a kid. So didn't know why. And as you get older and you get more knowledge, and especially with the internet now, obviously. Yeah. But there's a lot of rabbit holes and dangerous areas on the internet to watch out for. So, you know, people always watch what you... You know, don't... You know, try and verify sources, check and think you know, think what you're reading. Is this resonating with you?
Yeah.
Is it not? Well, it's probably wrong. Then leave it aside and move on.
Do you find that there's a you sort of develop a, I don't know what to call it really. It is a bit like a sixth sense, where as you're reading something or watching something nowadays, because of what you know, you tend to be able to think, this is garbage, you know.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that out there. And with all the nonsense going on at the moment with the, you know, geopolitical ISIS and all the stuff going on in France and all
ISIS, also known as the CIA. FBI, also known as the CIA.
I'm sure the listeners all know the truth about all that and where that money comes from and who's funding it. So with all that going on, yeah, it's just there's just so much happening. They seem to be firing it constantly at us.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing after another, one thing after another. I try not to get too sucked into it, but the way they manipulate you psychologically as well through the news and how they do that through the, you know, techniques of propaganda and Edward Bernays and all that good stuff. So so it's yeah, people just have to be aware. Yeah. And the more awareness you have, the more knowledge you'll have, really.
Yeah, that's right. So what sort of stuff happens in your chat room or blog room or whatever it is?
Well, I get a few regulars in. Hairy Cookie Monster, he pops in, and there's a few other lads who come regularly each week. And I've spent the last couple of years trying to get the balance right with people who come in, because obviously it's a live situation and it's just off the cuff.
Yeah.
I don't have anything written down generally. I will just I've got ideas and I've got, you know, topics, but it literally is just a live 2 hours, and hopefully people's microphones are wired up right.
Yeah.
There's not too much distraction and feedback and things like that, and Google sometimes plays up. So we just crack on with it, and I just keep doing it each week on a Wednesday at 8 o'clock.
Have you got an archive there?
Yeah, it goes back, like I say, 4 years on YouTube. So, yeah, it's just, you know, just pick one and have a listen.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're kind of running out of time for tonight, because obviously I want to go and drink beer and stuff and not play any tunes tonight. However, we would like to come back on raconteursnews.com on Saturday night, probably do a bonus Dr. Rock show between 9 and 11, by which time, Pete, I'll have had a chance to have a look at your website and we can have perhaps a longer chat.
Okay, no problem. That'd be good.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for joining us for that. It's been really, really great. And I look forward to catching up. Yeah. And we'll have a look at that. Where can people find your...
It's just the YouTube channel, Peter Howard. And you'll find it, Reality Chat. Just put Reality Chat in, it will come out. It'll pop up.
Sounds like another interesting source of stuff, doesn't it, folks? Well, thanks very much, Pete. So we're coming to the end of another show, because I'd like to play some just a couple of tunes on the way out. As I said, this has been a totally Welsh sunshine-powered 12-volt open-source outing for Dr. Rock. It is how the surgery likes to do things. Really enjoyed chatting with all the guests tonight, some of whom I haven't even met or chatted to before, so that was really good sport as well. Thanks, obviously, to Dark Wolf for letting us have his handsome space to broadcast from, and to raconteursnews.com, whose name I even managed to remember this week, for continuing to host me, even though I can't remember who the feck they are. Some people are just so good, aren't they? I'm going to play a little Tracy Curtis song, because we like a little bit of Tracy Curtis toward the end of the show. And then there'll probably be some Slade or some Motorhead. You know me. And hopefully we'll be back with you Saturday night, 9 o'clock, live from a field in Glyndebwrdwy. See if you can spell that. See you soon, folks. Thanks for being there.